Lesson 8, Prepositions. 8.1, Vocabulary List. We have already seen that prepositions can have their objects in more than one form. This is important because some prepositions change meaning depending on the form of their objects. This particular list, prepositions, I have listed according to how many forms the preposition is used with. If the object of the preposition only occurs in one form, it will be found in this first seven prepositions listed. If it's found with two forms, the second list, and then with three forms, the third list. So I'm going to go through these prepositions, just reading the preposition, and it is up to you, of course, to memorize which form the preposition is used with. I've listed it according both by name and by form number, and the various translations. And there's a reason that Greek prepositions have more than one translation, and we'll discuss that in a few moments. So we'll go through the list. First, ana, anti, apa, eis, ek or ex, both are used, pra, soon. These seven prepositions occur only with one form, even though they have multiple translations. Seven prepositions are used with two forms. I will read them for you. Dia, in, kata, meta, peri, huper, hupa. Notice the last two have rough breathings over the initial vowel. These prepositions are used with two forms. I've listed the form by name and the translation for that form for each of those prepositions. These are the simple translations. You must memorize these. There's no other way to do it. It takes time. I realize that. It took us all time to do that. And you have to review them regularly. I still review these as I go through the New Testament. I have this list, and I go through this list all the time just to make sure that I keep fresh in my mind the various translations, simple translations of prepositions. The third list has only three prepositions in it. They are used with three distinct forms. The first is epi, and then on the next page, para and pros. And you can look at the forms and the translations, and you'll see that there are also some implications for these particular forms, and we'll talk about those as they occur. Now, the spatial force of some prepositions. Most prepositions do have a spatial force, and in fact, that was probably the original force of the preposition. But as time goes on, prepositions took upon other forces, non-spatial forces. So I write in this paragraph, besides the actual spatial meanings, however, there are the non-spatial meanings. Outside the Gospels, the great majority of the uses of prepositions in the New Testament will not be of the spatial type. Even in the Gospels, the logical relationships of the Greek prepositions present themselves in great number, the logical or the non-spatial relationships. Why? Well, the reason has to do with the nature of the presentation. In the Gospels, you have many historical narrative passages, so-and-so did such-and-such, and oftentimes prepositional phrases are used in the spatial sense, going through travels and so on. When you get into the teaching passages in the Gospels, and when you get into the teaching epistles, then, of course, the more non-spatial uses of the prepositions are used. Oh, by the way, this is also true in the book of Acts, which has both historical narrative where there's more spatial uses of the prepositions and teaching passages in which there are non-spatial or logical uses of the prepositions. So be aware that these two functions occur quite a lot. We do the same thing in English, so that shouldn't really bother you, although it may not have ever been pointed out to you, but we do exactly the same thing in English, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go through. Section 8.3, the function of prepositional phrases. Now, this section is divided into four parts. The first part is titled Kinds of Prepositional Phrases. A phrase is a group of words that act like one word. That is, the phrase is considered a single part of speech, one word. The most common phrases in Greek are prepositional phrases, which are normally used as one of two parts of speech, either an adverb or an adjective. In English, adjective prepositional phrases are common, in fact, quite common, while in Koine Greek they are more rare. However, both adjective and adverbial prepositional phrases do occur in the New Testament. As with all adjectives, adjective prepositional phrases modify nouns. Adverbial prepositional phrases modify verbs. Context is the final determining factor as to which function the phrase fulfills. This is, by the way, identical to English. In English, we only have context. So you have to pay very close attention when you're translating prepositional phrases and thinking about them. The purpose of the Greek preposition. Greek prepositions help refine the case function of a noun. For instance, an ablative noun is often translated with from as though it were a prepositional phrase. Since the basic meaning of the ablative is separation, it is possible to be separated from something in a way that cannot be expressed by the word from. For instance, the word pra, followed by a noun in the ablative form, that is, form 2, means before, a word that also relates to separation. If you're before something, you're separated from it. The object of pra is always in the ablative, that is, ablative case, form 2, as in the following example. Example, hoi prophetai eson pra tu Christu. Now, that's translated, the prophets were, eson is the past tense of to be, the prophets were before Christ, pra to Christu. Oh, this also gives me pause. Oftentimes, proper names are accompanied by the word the before them in Greek. We don't do that at all in English. But since Greek names are definite and the Greek, are specific, I shouldn't have used the word definite. That's an English term. The specific, they are specific to the individual. It is not unusual for them to have the word the with them, even if you cannot translate it into English. So while without the preposition, the form to Christu, the word could mean either of Christ as a genitive or from Christ as an ablative. The preposition pra narrows the meaning of to Christu to the ablative meaning before Christ. So that's what a preposition does. It limits the function of the noun following it in such a way as the case or the function of the noun is more specifically identified. So prepositions don't determine the meaning of the following noun. They narrow the meaning of the following noun. Now this is different than in English. In English, prepositions carry the meaning within the preposition so that the noun is basically distinct from the prepositional phrase because we have no endings in English that correspond to the various forms of the Greek noun. So this important concept becomes more important as you see idiomatic uses of prepositional phrases in Greek. And that's why in second year and in third year Greek, we look at prepositional phrases in much more detail. They are fun to study because they help us understand the precision of the Greek language insofar as it can be precise with using prepositional phrases. The inefficiency of the Greek preposition, however, limits this precision. Many other examples could be given than the one I gave before, pra tu Christu, but it is evident that the simple use of the case system itself without prepositions is not sufficient to express all the meanings needed in a language. Prepositions, then, help the case functions by refining them beyond their simple meaning. Sometimes a form can occur where we might expect a different form. Hupa, followed by a noun in form 2, indicating agency, for example. Agency is normally indicated by the instrumental case form, which is form 3, but hupa, indicating agency, is followed by form 2, which is actually the ablative or the genitive ablative form. It's actually in form, it's not a genitive or an ablative. It's actually an instrumental, even though it doesn't look like an instrumental. That's the problem. Prepositions are not as specific in Greek as they are in English. They have to have multiple meanings. Since each of the Greek cases carries its own force, the prepositions indicate an extension of that force. For general information purposes, note the following chart. Now, I've given you a chart here that indicates the case, and you'll notice that these are case nominatives form 1, genitive ablative form 2, dative locative instrumental form 3, accusative form 4 in the left-hand column, then the force of the case in just a general way, and then the various prepositions that precede that case. For instance, the nominative case, which is generally referred to as the naming case, has no prepositions that precede it. It cannot. The genitive case, the descriptive case, the description case, can have anti, kata, meta, peri, huper, epi, and pros before it. The ablative case, the separation case, can have apa, ek, pra, dia, which is translated through when it's with the ablative case, hupa, and para. So it can have those prepositions before it. The dative case, the interest case, has no prepositions before it. It is a very limited case. It can either mean two or four, and it just rarely has any prepositional function other than that, and if it does, it's probably not truly a dative. It's either a locative or an instrumental, the next two, or maybe even a case that's not named, and this does occur. There are places where there are cases that don't fit under case functions that do not fit under any of these. The locative, the location case, can be preceded by soon, in, epi, para, and pros. The instrumental, the means case, can be preceded by in, which also is used with a locative, but when it precedes the instrumental, it means by or by means of. The accusative is the limitation case, and it carries all of these prepositions before it. Ana, dia, ice, kata, meta, peri, huper, hupa, epi, para, pros. Some scholars, A.T. Robertson, for instance, believe that the original case in language, the original form in the Greek language, was the limitation case accusative. I'm not sure that that can be proven, but it is certainly the most functional of all the cases in many ways. The vocabulary list for this lesson identifies 17 prepositions, and I've given them to you in whether they have one, two, or three forms that they precede. There are other irregular prepositions which must be identified as they occur. These are actually adverbs, but they function as though they were prepositions. For most uses, the prepositions listed in this lesson are all there are, making Greek very weak in its number of prepositions. Compare this lack of prepositions in Greek with English, which is very rich in prepositions. The following provides the 52 most common single word prepositions in English, or English prepositions. I'm not going to read those. You can read them yourself. By the way, these are not always prepositions. Sometimes they're nouns. For instance, the word round at the bottom of the third column, and so on. Sometimes they can be adverbs, as underneath. Now, Greek does this as well. It uses a word as an adverb and then sometimes as a preposition. But when we say underneath the bed, we're using underneath as a preposition. But when we say the man is on top and the bucket of nails is underneath the scaffold, the word underneath there is used as a preposition. So These words are, English is very rich in preposition. Just look at the number of words. Look at the next list. In addition to the above list, English has several multiple word prepositions. Below are the 24 most common multiple word English prepositions, and I've given them to you. If you count them all up, oh, by the way, in that chart continues on to the next page. If you count them all up, English has regular use, 76 different prepositions in these two lists. Clearly, Greek is deficient in prepositions. Clearly it is. Look at all the prepositions. That means that while English is rich, the Greek prepositions must do multiple work. That's why you see them with various cases and various translations, even within one case or one form. And there are case functions that even in English we don't really define. They don't define them in Greek, but they don't fit under any of the common names. And the problem, of course, is that it becomes difficult to understand and translate because there's so many possibilities for Greek prepositions. One of the great studies that have been done by scholars is in the uses of prepositions. Dana and Manti, in their Greek grammar, the manual grammar of the Greek New Testament, talk much about this. In fact, Manti did some of his great study on the Greek preposition. A.T. Robertson also does quite a bit of study on Greek prepositions. So, if you continue in your Greek studies, you're going to be spending a lot of time thinking about and using Greek prepositions. They are very important and somewhat complicated in their approach. But it's a wonderful study because it gives a richness to the Greek language that is very good. The translation of Greek prepositions, then, is the next section here. The vocabulary list provides sufficient translations for each preposition for first-year studies. In intermediate Greek, that is second year, one studies the prepositional system in detail, at which time the student will examine several other translations of the Greek prepositions. However, this does remind us that translation is not the ultimate goal of studying Greek. Sometimes prepositions will be translated without the use of English prepositions. This is because English cannot accurately translate all the prepositional uses, so we must get as close as we can. While realizing that some grammatical elements cannot be translated accurately, but must be explained by the teacher. One of the things that happens in Greek rather regularly is that prepositions are used before infinitives. We never do that in English, at least not the way Greek does it. And those prepositions often cannot be translated at all. So that's something for advanced Greek studies. Just a heads up, though. Study this thoroughly, prepositions thoroughly. Take your time, do it right, and you will be greatly rewarded. Section 8.4, the dropping of final letters in prepositions. Sometimes we drop a letter in English, especially in contractions. The words do not are contracted to don't, for instance. The apostrophe indicates that we drop the letter O from not, do not, don't. The dropping of a letter is called elision. Greek also elides letters. Elides is the verbal form of elision. If the preposition ends in a short vowel and the next word begins with a vowel, the common practice was to drop the final vowel of the preposition. In addition, if the following word has a rough breathing rather than a smooth, it can affect the final consonant of the preposition according to the square of the mutes that we studied in Lesson 1. Note the following changes. I'm going to read these through for you. The basic preposition, then how it's found before the smooth breathing, and then how it's found before a rough breathing. Anti, before a smooth breathing, is still anti. Before a rough breathing, it becomes anth. The iota drops, and the tau becomes a theta because the rough breathing causes that to happen. apa becomes op before a smooth breathing and off before a rough breathing. Both cases, the final omicron is dropped. Dia becomes D before both smooth and rough breathing. Kata becomes kat before a smooth breathing and kath before a rough breathing. Meta becomes met or meth. Hupa becomes hoop or hoof. Para becomes par or par, the same for both. Epi becomes ep or f. You will find these regularly. When I provide a Greek translation or Greek presentation for you, examples, I always put an apostrophe when a prepositional phrase is shortened by elision. Some Greek texts do not do that. For instance, you'll often see in some Greek texts D without any apostrophe following it to indicate that it's dia, that the alpha has been dropped. But I try to keep that consistent just to help the student. Section 8.5, prepositions added to the beginning of words, of verbs. Sometimes Greek adds prepositions to the beginning of verbs to extend or intensify their meaning. The use is called perfective, the perfective preposition, because the preposition somehow changes or perfects the meaning of or intensity of the verb itself. By the way, just so you know, the word perfect originally in English did not what it mean what it has come to mean now. To this day, the word perfect means without flaw. But originally it meant anything that is changed to make it more precise, more accurate, or whatever, especially in grammar. But even in the King James English, the word perfect did not mean what we mean by perfect. It is often used to translate words that we would translate mature, something of that nature. So it doesn't mean perfect in the sense of without flaw. So prefixed prepositions are called perfective prepositions. Note the following. It's on the next page. I've given you a little chart. These are illustrative. You'll see these in a lot of ways. For instance, with lambano, which means I take, lay hold of, or I receive. Paralambano means I take or receive from another. So usually the emphasis is on paralambano is its interaction between other people. We still sometimes just translate I take or receive, but in the back of our mind should be that this is an intensified lambano, and it implies there's some reception from another person. Balo, meaning I cast or I throw. Paralambano means I throw beside, as fodder to horses. I lay beside, I compare, I cross over. That little para changes a lot of the word balo in a multitude of ways. Likewise, right below it is another form of it, ek balo, which is more common, or that's not the right word, is more what we would expect. Ek means out, so ek balo means I cast out or I throw out. So it's not as complicated as paralambano. Look at blepo, the next one. I see. Ana blepo means I look up, because one of the meaning of ana is up. But ana has another meaning. It means again. And so it means I see again or I recover sight. This word is used a lot in the Gospels to refer to Jesus giving the sight to blind people. They recover their sight. Gnosko. I know, or I come to know, can even mean I came to understand, or I understand. But when you read anagnosko, here the word ana means again. I know again, I read. Because when you read something, you can know it over and over again by simply reading it again. Lego, I say. Anti lego, anti sometimes means against. So anti-lego means I contradict or I oppose, meaning I oppose by speaking. Also, if a verb is used before a prepositional phrase, often that preposition will be attached to the beginning of the verb without either extending or intensifying its meaning. Ray Summers uses the following example. ek phero dora ek tu oiku. I bring gifts out of the house. Now, you could translate ek phero, I bring out gifts out of the house, but that's redundant. So the ek phero doesn't really do anything except gives you a heads up that ek is perhaps coming along afterwards. To the Greeks, this must have been an instinctual usage. As noted in section 8.3, prepositional phrases act as a single part of speech, usually as an adverb, but sometimes as an adjective. When diagramming a prepositional phrase as an adverb, place the phrase on a modifying line beneath the verb which it modifies, with an object line between the preposition and its object. Example, Agenemain diakonos kata tein dorion karitas. Agenemain means I became. Diakonos is a servant. I became servant. We put the word a because English demands it. Kata, according to, tein dorion, the gift, caritas, of Christ. That's a simple possessive genitive, caritas. Grace. I said Christ. That's different. That's Christa. Never mind. That's Christu. Caritas is of grace. Notice the diagram. Agenemain does not have the ego, which is the word I, before it, so I place the word I in English before it. And then since it's a state of being verb, it has no direct object. Diakonos, which is in form one, you'll notice the ending, diakonos is the same as the word, the subject of the sentence, is a subject complement following a state of being verb. And I use the slanted line. We call that a complement line rather than an object line straight up and down. But the prepositional phrase, I became a slave according to the gift of Christ, is adverbial. It tells how I became a not slave, servant. I became a servant according to the gift of the grace of Christ. Notice that according to the gift of the grace of Christ. The word gift has the word the with it, so I diagram that underneath dorion. Of Christ is an adjectival noun. Genitive nouns, and there are a lot of them, and pronouns, are adjectival. They function as though they were adjectives. We don't do this in English. We always have to put them in a prepositional phrase, but caritas, although it's not a prepositional phrase, it's simply a noun in the genitive, acts as though it were a prepositional phrase of grace. Strange deal. That's the way these kinds of languages work. If you've ever studied German, it does the same kind of thing. It has case forms that act as though the noun was a prepositional phrase. In English, we must have the prepositional actually stated or written. Here's another example. When diagramming a prepositional phrase as an adjective, place it on a modifying line beneath the substantive which it modifies. And here's an interesting example. I chose one that's kind of a modification of something that Paul says about himself. Ego, paulos, hadesmios, huper, ton, ethnon, gnorizo, humen, ton, logon. Now, this is translated. Ego, I, paulos, in the nominative, Paul, hadesmios, the prisoner, also in the nominative case, huper, preposition, on behalf of, or in behalf of, ton ethnon, the Gentiles, ginorizo, I make known, to you the word of God, the word. It doesn't say of God here. I think it did originally, I think I took it out. Now, here's something that's really weird. Ginorizo, which is derived from gnosko, but it means I cause to know or make known. It's a separate verb, actually, than gnosko, even though it's related. But you'll notice that it has a slightly different stem. The iota has dropped out, and there are linguistic reasons for that. The word I is the subject. The word paulos is in apposition to I, and I use the double arrow to indicate apposition. Now, apposition is the simple fact that a noun can follow either a pronoun or another noun to more specifically identify it. So Paulos tells you who the I is more specifically, and then that is followed by another noun and apposition. Paul uses two appositions here with ego. Desmios identifies more carefully who Paulos is by way of description. Nouns do that. They more specifically identify by description sometimes when they're in apposition. The prisoner. Then underneath that is huper ton ethnon. He's a prisoner on behalf of the Gentiles. That's an adjectival use of the prepositional phrase huper ton ethnon. So these do occur in the New Testament. He's a prisoner on behalf of the Gentiles, according to this diagram. Now, there's differences of opinion. Some might think that huper ton ethnon is adverbial. I make known on behalf of the Gentiles. It's possible. You have to make a decision. And that's the problem with any kind of prepositional phrases in English and Greek or anything else. You have to look at the context and figure out which is more likely in this case. Well, in this case, since huper ton ethnon follows immediately after desmios, that is the word prisoner, it seems more likely that Paul intended him to say that he's a prisoner on behalf of the Gentiles rather than I make known on behalf of the Gentiles, which doesn't make a lot of sense. So huper ton ethnon is an adjectival prepositional phrase. 8.7 are the exercises. I will not read these through you, and this concludes our discussion of Lesson 8 of the Elementary Greek Grammar.